Last week, there was a news story about a young man near Boston who woke up after being in a coma for over a year. Actually, it turned out he wasn't in a coma, but had what they call the locked-in syndrome. So the whole time, he was awake and aware, but his body had been cut off from the signals from his brain, so he couldn't move or communicate, except to watch and listen to the hospital staff talk to his family about how unlikely he would recover. Or when his stepfather was called in to say his farewells, and his stepfather in tears told him it was okay for him to stop fighting and let go. If that wasn't bad enough, the whole time he was wrought with guilt because his condition was the result of heavy drug use, which started a few years earlier when his mother died. He couldn't get over that he had done this to himself. And he could see the turmoil he was causing his wife, his family, and the huge medical bill that he was saddling them with. He told the reporter that he felt so bad that he did math in his head the whole time to distract himself from the guilt. Sounds like he had what one of my professors describes as a delicate conscience. She said that one day, that we're the kind of people who feel guilty just talking to the border crossing guy, even though we have done nothing wrong. Once I had to do a wedding for someone in my congregation, but in Blaine. I was very nervous crossing the border because nobody seems to be able to tell me whether my role at the wedding was violating U.S. labor laws. So I was carpooling with these ladies. I was in the back seat, already feeling slightly guilty when we told the guy we were going to a wedding. And I was dreading the next question that he would ask, which is usually, what do you do for a living? Guess what he asked? He said, what gift did you bring them? I was stunned. Partly, I didn't know what the right answer was, but partly because I was not in the habit of getting a toaster for the couples I married, which got me feeling guilty about that. So I said, nothing. And he said, how come? Now I'm really stuck for a good answer. But before I could answer, he said, I tell you why not. Because you are cheap. And then he said, have a nice day, and waved us by. God made us with a conscience. Self-reflection is maybe one of the things that separate us from animals, I think. You know, when a dog tears up a room when the owner is out and is sitting head on paws at the corner, what's it thinking, really? Someone wrote that guilt is evidence of an inner life, because feeling guilty involves an awareness of our intentions and desires. And so any spirituality that is concerned with the inner life usually has some sort of practice of self-examination and reflection. And regret and lament is certainly the dominant theme in the Psalms, is the interior journey with God, modeled in prayer and poetry. And when we find something we don't feel proud of, then we're in need of mercy. For the Jewish people, introspection is built into their calendar. A few times a year on feast days when people would pilgrimage to the temple to worship. And Psalm 130, it's a psalm of ascent. It's sung by pilgrims as they walk up the road on the Temple Mount. They sing the song as preparation to meet God in worship, which begins with making sacrifices for their sins. So this is reflecting on the state of their being, the moments before they do business for their failures, so that they're specific about what they need mercy for. If we were to regularly own up to our mistakes and missteps, the less attractive aspects of our humanity, then we need to have an active conscience, some sense of what ought to be, what kind of person we want to be, which I think in some part are the values we were brought up with mixed in with what we have come to adopt from people we admire, our influences. And for Christians, we would also have what we understand as God's core values that we have come to embrace as our own. So then regret and remorse, it's the light on our spiritual dashboard that alerts us when we have violated one of our core values, that we have in some way failed to be the kind of person we set out to be. This is what our psalmist is feeling as he does his spiritual inventory. He has trespassed his own core values and God's, and he's in need of mercy. So verse 1, out of the depths, I cry to you, Lord. Lord, hear my voice. Let your ears be attentive to my cry for mercy. If you, Lord, kept a record of sins, Lord, who could stand? Do you have some sort of practice for introspection? Do you find it hard or easy to look in the mirror and just honestly inventory who you are, the kind of person you are being at the moment? It's not easy. It's kind of like this joke about a guy who says his doctor suggested that a way to lose weight is to begin every meal by looking at himself in front of a mirror naked. His friend asks, does it work? He says, yeah, it works. But then the waiter usually asks me to leave. The truth in that joke is that most of our regrets involve other people. It's the people who are pained by our choices and actions. When I do premarital counseling, when the couple tells me they never argue, I get a bit nervous. Whoever says love is never having to say you're sorry is probably single or lying. It's hard to imagine not ever having to say you're sorry in any relationship where people are people and they're being themselves and they care about each other. It's not just because human beings are flawed, but also because we're all different. We're bound to rub each other the wrong way, even if we don't mean to on purpose. Still, it's a very unpleasant thing, like spreading out all the ugliest pictures of us and looking at them. Depending on how you were brought up to view mistakes, guilt that we have done a bad thing can be made much worse by shame that we do bad things because we're bad people. There are apparently these business camps in Japan where corporations send their executives as a kind of punishment for poor performance. And all they seem to do for 2 weeks is to yell out what a failure they are as managers. And when they identify something they failed to do well, the coaches would pin a sin ribbon on their smock. So by the end of the 2 weeks, they're covered in the shame of their failures and weeping and promising to do better. The British host of the documentary was gobsmacked. She couldn't understand the point of the exercise or why it was helpful. What's the point of this record of sin worn on the outside for all to see? I too found it very uncomfortable to watch. The psalmist hopes God doesn't keep a record of sin, because who of us, he asks, can bear the weight of all the ways we have failed to be our best selves? But even if God doesn't keep a record of our failures, we do, don't we? If there isn't some way that we can make right our failures, and if there isn't someone who tells us we are forgiven. Our record of wrong is the theme of Macbeth, when he and his wife conspired and killed the king, but underestimated the weight of the guilt that would plague them. Lady Macbeth kept seeing bloodstains on her hands that she couldn't wash off, and she went mad. That's why the Jewish people have their sacrifice rituals, and the Catholics do confessions in those booths where priests prescribe some sort of remedial thing to do and pronounce, you are forgiven. Last week, the Regina version of our P&E got a letter in the mail with $230 in it. And this note, many years ago when I was a teenager, I worked at the admissions gate. I needed money to buy Christmas presents that year, and I didn't put every customer through the till in order to keep some of the money. I have felt guilty about it since then, and I want to return the money back. I'm so sorry I stole it, and I regret doing it. Imagine carrying that guilt for years. She was keeping a record of wrong, even though no one else knew about it. This person decided to come clean and own her mistake and make restitution, when someone else might have said, oh, I forgive myself because I was in a bad slot. Or everyone does it, don't they? Or it's not so bad, it's just a little bit of money. Or we bury the memory behind a sanitized facade of ourselves that we present to the world and try to fool people into thinking that we could never do something as bad as that, as they might do. Apparently, there's a book out that frames guilt as, I quote, the obstacle to your first class life, unquote. The guilt is something to dismiss so we can become successful. This is what a book reviewer writes. So the guilt that blocks and inhibits us also propels us to work, 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 to become relentlessly productive in the hope that we might, by our good works, rid ourselves of guilt, what many people consider the most unbearable emotion. If religion often gets the blame for framing man as sinner, the secular effort to release man from his guilt hasn't offered much relief. By falsely promising a blank slate, modernity may not only have failed to obliterate man's subjective guilt, but may even have exacerbated it. As such, the religion's assignation of man a sinner, a fallen, abject, endlessly compromised, but also active, effective, and changeable creature, begins to look comforting by comparison. It's counterintuitive that God's offer for us to come clean, as hard as that may be, is actually more comforting by comparison. I remember one of the courses I've taken in my life said, change begins with a reckoning of where we are. Our soul health and our relational health depends on an honest checkup now and then, so we can make some course adjustment if that's what's called for. What made self-reflection and confession doable for the psalmist was that he knows exactly what God is like, that God is chesed, faithful kindness, and he knows exactly what he can expect from God, mercy. Verse 4, but with you there is forgiveness, so that we can with reverence serve you. And he knows exactly what to do with the ugly he finds as he climbs the hill towards the temple. That in a few moments when he gets to the temple at the top of the climb, he will confess and take ownership of the failures by way of a sacrifice. And then he will wash in the basin and feel God's forgiveness on him. A true clean slate. Christian spirituality invites self-examination with a couple of provisions to make it safe. Firstly, Jesus and the Spirit is with us in the process, the way a lawyer sits next to someone at the police station during interrogation. The Spirit is the one who comes alongside, the comforter, the advocate. The Spirit makes sure we can be truthful and it's going to be okay. Secondly, the goal of Christian self-examination is not to shame us, but to come clean to God and receive healing in our soul. God doesn't hold grudges, Scripture assures us, that God not only forgives, but he will act like he forgets once we have dealt with it. After all, God is not surprised by our failures, I don't think, since he already knows everything about us. And yet, God still doesn't expect us to be better than we are, so we don't even have to pretend. With God, we always get to be ourselves, as we are. Saint Thérèse of Lisieux writes that God is a God who punishes with a kiss. She writes this: what can change a heart? What can melt bitterness, bring to remorse, and give us the courage to finally give up all the rationalizing we do? What single thing can move us to admit the misery and sin we live in? Not any kind of threat of punishment. The heart is moved and purified through a kiss. Healthy spirituality allows us to be honest about who we are, to own up to our mistakes without the mental gymnastics. And because of who God is as Father, Son, and Spirit, as Hesed, we're not threatened by our failures or that we fail, because we can count on mercy to come as a kiss. So the psalmist describes waiting for that kiss, like a night watchman just before the end of a shift at dawn. I imagine what a watchman feels at the end of shift is that he's really tired. He just wants to go to sleep. It's what I remember feeling one summer in university working in Surrey and trying to drive home every day in the afternoon rush hour. I was so tired, I don't even remember how many times I nodded off. But the watchman cannot let up because he doesn't want to miss someone breaking in when he's most vulnerable. The psalmist doesn't want to nod off and miss the moment when God's mercy comes to kiss him on the cheek. With all of God's reassurances about his mercy and grace, he doesn't seem worried that we would take forgiveness for granted. Maybe because we don't become calloused to our failures because we're too much steeped in grace. Rather, our conscience become callous when all our guilty feelings get stored up and become unbearable. And the only way to function is to tune it out. It's like cooks with iron fingers. Their fingers get used to the heat. The way that proverbial frog that can't feel the water heating up around it and it gets cooked. So Paul, in Ephesians 4:30, warns us about grieving the Holy Spirit by habitually ignoring his alerts to self-examination, and we become desensitized to our own failings because self-reflection is hard and feels bad. But God doesn't want us to do self-reflection because he wants us to feel bad. Although if we do feel bad about what we find, that's a thing to have a conversation with God about. The point of self-reflection is for our soul health and our ability to stay soft in relationships with God and with people we care about. It's probably not far-fetched to suggest that people who do great evil got that way because they do not self-reflect, and they lost their humanity because evil felt normal. And it's in facing our own dark side that brings us into the feeling of the love of God. When we get good at looking at ourselves in the mirror honestly, and if we believe that God is a gracious Father who loves us and holds no grudge, then feeling God's kiss of mercy on us is how God's love becomes something we can feel and not just know. And every time we need mercy and it comes, we recalibrate our understanding of God and our trust in God becomes a little tougher. This is a little paragraph from the novel Silence. Sin, he reflected, is not what is usually thought to be. It's not to steal and tell lies. Sin is for one man to walk brutally over the life of another and to be quite oblivious of the wounds he has left behind. And then, for the first time, a real prayer rose up in his heart. I'm sure it's through self-reflection that David concludes in Psalm 103 that the Lord is compassionate and gracious, slow to anger, abounding in love. For as high as the heavens are above the earth, so great is his love for those who fear him. As far as the east is from the west, so far has he removed our transgression from us. Thérèse of Lisieux was a nun in the 1800s. She became a nun at 15, but she died at 24 of tuberculosis. She wrote a book of her spiritual journey that impacted a lot of people long after she died. My mission, she writes, is to make God loved as I love him, to teach souls my little way. And someone who admires her wrote this. Whenever I struggle in my faith, it's usually because I have let my own failings, sins, and shortcomings become greater in my mind than the mercy and love of God. I have lost all perspective of myself in the hands of a Father who loves me. Saint Thérèse is a perfect reminder that every day, no matter our struggles, all we need to do is simply turn to God and throw ourselves into his arms and ask for help, confident that he understands our failings and loves us as we are and towards who we will become. We can be honest about our own failings and not be destroyed by the feelings of failures, because God's love and mercy is always greater than our failures. And Saint Thérèse calls this her little way of love and confidence. Frederick Buechner wrote a book called Peculiar Treasures. It's a dictionary of Bible characters. And there's an entry for Jacob, whom he calls a crook for good reasons. You remember, he cheated his brother a couple of times and literally pulled the wool over his dad's eyes and swindled his uncle out of livestock and daughters. He was such a scoundrel that he had to run away from home because his brother wanted him dead. While he was on the run, one night he had a dream. So this is Buechner. You might think that what happened next was that he lay there all night, bug-eyed as a result of his guilty conscience, or if he did manage to drop off, that he was tormented by conscience-stricken dreams. But neither of these was the case. Instead, he dropped off like a baby in a cradle and dreamed the kind of dreams you would have thought were reserved for the high saints. He dreamed that there was a ladder reaching up to heaven and there were angels moving up and down it. And there, standing somewhere above, was God himself. And the words God spoke in the dreams were not the chewing out you might have expected, but something altogether different. God told him that the land he was lying on was to belong to him and his descendants. And someday his descendants would be a great nation and a great blessing to all the nations on earth. And as if that wasn't enough, he then added a personal PS by saying, "Behold, I am with you and will keep you wherever you go." The lesson was, needless to say, that even for a dyed-in-the-wool, double-barrel con artist like Jacob, there are a few things in this world you cannot get, but can only be given. One of these things is love in general. And another is the love of God in particular. Jacob didn't have to climb this ladder to bilk heaven of moon and the stars, even if that had been possible. Because the moon and the stars looked like jelly beans compared to what God and the angels were using the ladder to hand down to him for free. Another part of the lesson was that, luckily for Jacob, God doesn't love people because of who they are, but because of who he is. It's on the house, is one way of saying it, and it's by grace, another. Just as it was by grace that it was Jacob of all people who became not only the father of the 12 tribes of Israel, but the many times great grandfather of Jesus of Nazareth. And just as it was by grace that Jesus of Nazareth was born into this world at all. Let me give you a moment to begin a conversation with God. And then I'll read you Malcolm Guite's version of Psalm 130. Here's Malcolm Guite. Ask him for mercy, you won't be denied. Call on him from the deep, the places where the child in you has cried all night unhurt, and where your spirit weeps as Rachel wept and would not be consoled. Cry from the place where grief unspoken seeps into a bitter silence, never told and never healed. So cry out from the deep. Bring every grief to God. Do not withhold a tear from him. Give him your tears to keep, for they are precious to him. Flee to him. His heart was pierced, and he knows how to weep. For he is full of mercy, and with him is plenteous redemption. Let him sound the depths that he might draw you out from them. Amen.